This is the Mentoring Developers Podcast, episode number 14.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 14 of Mentoring Developers. In the last episode, I was talking to Reuven Lerner in part one of the interview, and we talked about a lot of things. In particular, we talked about his degrees. He has a PhD degree in learning sciences, and he has a bachelor's degree from MIT in computer science. I know that's a question on a lot of your minds. A lot of people ask me if they should get a bachelor's degree or an associate degree in computer science or a master's degree, but he has a PhD. So it was a very good discussion to talk about the need to get a PhD degree and the motivation behind it, to give you a different perspective. We have talked to people who have very different degrees. Some people have no degrees. Some people don't even have high school diplomas, but they're very good developers. So you certainly don't need a degree to be qualified as a developer, but it gives you something. And we want to make that a little bit more tangible instead of just saying that, hey, it's nice to have, well, what is nice about it? So I think that's a good episode. In this episode, this is part two of the interview. I conclude my discussion with Reuven, and we talk about launching a career in software development. We talk about his past. We talk about drip campaigns, which are email campaigns that you can do as a software developer, as an entrepreneur. But he certainly does that. And we talk about why you do it and what's a good way of doing it. And we talk about the writing that you need to do, writing techniques for blogs and so on. You need to write, you need to communicate, you need to let people know your ideas, and it's a skill that's very important. I think that every developer should develop the skill and hone it. It takes years and years of practice, but the best time to start is right now. Most developers, most people in general, don't like to write. So if you're one of those people who can write, who can communicate, who can advise people, who can empathize with people, then you will connect. And then you can connect with potential employers, and you can connect with colleagues. Certainly, you can provide mentorship, and you can also get mentorship by writing. So it's a fantastic episode. I'm really excited, and I would like for you to listen to it very carefully and give me your feedback. My email address is us@mentoringdevelopers.com. You can also tweet at me at mentoringdevs. And you can also leave a comment on iTunes, mentoringdevelopers.com/iTunes. Or you can leave a comment on the blog post. So mentoringdevelopers.com/episode14. Whichever way is comfortable for you, whichever way is easy for you, let us know your advice and your comments and your questions. And I'll tell you a little bit later about a giveaway that I'm going to do. And it's really exciting, and I'm really excited about it. And just watch out for that in somewhere in the middle of the interview or maybe towards the end. Okay, here's Reuven. Now let's listen in to part two of the interview. Really, really good information that you gave us, but I wanted to break it down and just to, because I have a little bit experience and a little bit exposure to some of this, just for people to understand the amount of work that we're talking about and money, because you're talking about a drip campaign, which somebody may not be familiar with that. A drip campaign is an email campaign where it's the word campaign is also troublesome, because maybe it's a little troubling term because it can be used in a political environment. It could mean something else, but we're talking about a marketing campaign, and in the sense that you want to sell something to a group of people, whether you want to sell a subscription or whatever, and you want people to get these emails and go through a set of emails one after another, email sequence, and then at the end of it, you want to sell them something. In your case, you're probably selling them membership into your bigger emailing list. Is that true?
Right. So many people are familiar with the idea of an autoresponder, right? Where you send email to an alias and you get mail automatically back. And so an email campaign or a drip campaign is sort of a glorified long-term or longer-term autoresponder, where you send email or you say, I want to sign up, and every day for N days, you get a new email message. So on Sunday, you'll get this. On Monday, you'll get that. On Tuesday, you'll get that, until the drip campaign runs out. And that's where what's called an email course comes in, right? So you can teach people over time in these bite-sized nuggets. And so my point of these courses is basically to get people onto my main email list. Why? So that they can then get information from me on a regular basis. Why? Because if they hear from me on a regular basis, they will, quite crassly but truly, be interested in buying my products. Now, I also know that the overwhelming majority of people are not going to buy my products, and that's okay. Like, I want people to buy them if they think they're really going to be useful to them, and as the saying goes now, provide value to them. But it is totally okay for me to talk to people either in countries where they can't afford it, or students, or whatnot, where they just want to interact and learn. And I love that, right? Like, if I can make a living only from, 10%, 20% of the people buying, then I'm okay with that. And I'm happy with other people learning too. So here's another thing I've done. I've started doing webinars every month and a half or so. And so that gets on YouTube. And so all these things sort of feed into my main list so that I can grow my following, so that when I want to sell something, I can, even though I know most people are not going to buy from me.
So that's a lot of information. First, you have to write the emails. First, you have to create a campaign, right? Which means that you have to sign up with, don't do it from your own Gmail account, right? You need to have a service that provides this function, because you don't want to be banned for spamming.
And you can't really do it easily yourself. I used to laugh at these companies. I don't anymore. Right? I was like, really? You need a company to send email for you? But they provide a lot of value. And Drip, I'm just beginning to scratch the surface more and more. You can do an amazing amount of stuff with automation there. So you definitely have to sign up with them, which is not, it's like $50 a month. Right, and so you need a server somewhere. Actually, I guess you don't need a server. You need the domain. You need you need the company. You need to write the material. Yeah.
You need to write the material. You need to produce a sequence, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So let's say there's six emails that are going to go out in a sequence. You have to write those emails, and that's copywriting, and there's some skill there. And then you need to have a message at the end, a compelling message, like in your case, get on my mailing list, I suppose. And then after that, once you get on your mailing list, then you have to write content for that. And then you have to maybe weekly or monthly or however frequently you want to do it, you have to give them some kind of value. Why would they open the emails? Give them something. So there is some writing there. And then you are paying monthly to this company called Drip, which is a fantastic company, I'm sure of it. But there are other companies, like there's AWeber and there's MailChimp. MailChimp has a free version, very limited.
Drip is true.
Drip is very developer-focused, so that's good. But it's $50, but that's for their basic plan. I'm not sure what are the higher tiers for, and maybe if you're very successful, you'll pay more. But
here we go. I just went to their pages. You pay $100 a month if you have 5,000 subscribers or more.
Okay, so it's still pretty low. Now, when you're making a lot of money, you're a consultant, you make a sizable amount of money, which you should.
Sometimes.
Well, your skills are in demand. People want to learn from you, and people want to give you projects. And I'm sure that you have the other problem of turning away people. And that's a good problem to have in a certain stage in your career. That's how it should be. But for somebody who is starting out, maybe they have a few years of experience, but they don't have a name, they don't have a reputation per se. They want to follow in your footsteps. They'll run into some issues. One of them is money, and the other one is the time. And it's obviously more valuable that you will be spending several hours every week. I don't know how many hours you spend, but I would expect to spend 10 hours or more every week on these activities without any obvious and clear and immediate return on investment. But you're doing it because you're thinking long term. You're thinking in a year, 2 years, 3 years, this, I will have a following, and then I will be able to use that following to sell products. And even if you do sell products, there's no guarantee that you will be making a lot of money or replacing your current income. You'll be augmenting it. But you're thinking long term, you're thinking retirement, you're thinking I want to have some passive income. You're thinking larger because you already accomplished so much in the way you're doing things right now, but you're looking ahead. And for somebody who's starting out, they would love to be in your position, right? To be able to train or just to be able to do consulting for a good hourly rate. But as we know that you can't sustain that lifestyle. I think that it's hard to sustain a consulting lifestyle over 40 years. And that's probably why we see a lot of people moving into a little bit more passive income and products. What do you think about this idea of consulting versus working, you know, getting a job and this idea of having this job security?
I have no complaints, no criticism of people who do that. Right? So when my wife and I got married, she asked me at some point, so how much do you make per month? I said, well, it depends on the month. And she was like, what? Right? And that's the nature of the beast. Granted, I'm very fortunate now where I'm working with these big companies where we schedule courses many months in advance. So I have a good sense, assuming the course is not canceled, I have a good sense of what my monthly income will be. But it still varies. And if something blows up, like this month, I had two courses canceled on me from Cisco just because not enough people signed up. Unfortunately, another company said, oh, actually, we'd love that spot, or we'd love part of that time. So it wasn't a total wash, wasn't a total loss. So I'm fortunate that way. But what was I going to say? The month-to-month variation and running after people, and maybe they don't pay you, maybe they don't pay you on time, and then have to deal with billing and accounting. I think it's totally reasonable to have a job at a big company or even a small company, do a good job there, you know, make a good income, come home, be with your family, and not be crazed with work all the time. I've been doing this for so long, and this is the norm for me. And in some ways, it's not a healthy norm because I'm just constantly dealing with work stuff and work things are constantly interrupting me, family, whatever. So I need to definitely push back. And it's funny, like you keep saying, oh, I'm so accomplished, so accomplished. You know, I look to other consultants and other people who are at the top of their game, and I think, wow, I wish I could be in their shoes, right? You know, I wish I could be, you know, a Paul Jarvis or, you know, Jonathan Stark or, or Brennan Dunn. Because what are they doing? They basically have found clients who will pay them so well that they can spend a day or two each week writing or a day or two each week working on new projects or doing things. And that's sort of my next goal, is to get to, like, a year from now. I've been saying this now for 6 months, so we'll see when it actually happens. But a year from now, basically teach maybe 2 weeks out of the year, of the month, 3 weeks out of the month, and the other time work on new ebooks, new content, new courses, new things that I can sell for that passive income. Because quite frankly, yeah, first of all, it's an amazing feeling. If you've never done it before, getting email from a payment provider saying that someone has bought your thing and you've never met them before in your life and you've never heard of them before is an amazing feeling. And the only thing that beats that is getting email from them saying, wow, I loved what you did. All right, that's just like totally makes my month. So I'd love to be there in another year where I'm just doing lots and lots of content. And then hopefully it'll all build on itself. But it is. Brennan Dunn is the one who told me it's a long game. In order to do this sort of thing, in order to be one of these sorts of consultants who has lots of passive income, you have to be willing to put in the time. And that's a hard thing to do. If you're consulting and you're working 40 hours a week, when the heck are you going to find the time to write? And if you're working a full-time job and trying to break into consulting, it's even harder, especially if you have a family. And so my solution has been a very poor one, which is just not to sleep very much. And it's not something I necessarily recommend, but it's sort of been a reality with me for a while that I'm trying to break. Right, this is a habit that's not good for me, not good for my family.
Yeah, I find myself in a similar situation because I'm trying to run this podcast. I work as a consultant full time, and in a similar situation, I have to spend extra hours. The whole family has to sacrifice for this. Everybody has to pitch in. They're pitching in with taking care of their you know, taking care of themselves and not having me around. And it hurts me because I want to go to the zoo and I want to have fun with them. But either I do that or I bring, you know, this podcast to the people. I feel like this is a very important service that I'm providing, and something that was in my head for many years. And I really thought that somebody would come up and talk about mentorship and diversity and all these other issues that I think are really relevant and important, but nobody is doing it. So I figured it was up to me to do it. But if I have to do it, then I have to do it consciously. I have to make a commitment to it. And it's just as important as my day job.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're doing. And you're spending even more time than probably I'm spending on this podcast because I'm a good writer. I write and I write well. I think that it's okay to admit if you have a strength. This is one of my strengths, but it still stresses me out when I have to write in an email or have to think about a plan, a strategy, because you don't just write random stuff. You have an end goal in mind. It's really emotionally for me. It's taxing, and I'm sure it is for you as well. It's not the easiest thing in the world to write these emails and autoresponder sequences. You have to be very organized. And in order to do that...
I wish.
I mean, you have to be organized. Otherwise, you just can't do it. Like, if you have to do it for 2 years or 3 years, like Jonathan Stark was saying, like Brendan is telling you, and you really have to do it for so many years because you don't want to make $100 a month, right? That's not enough for you. You want to make enough money that... if you didn't want to teach or train people anymore, you could do that. That's your goal, right?
That's right. Look, I'm fortunate that I've been writing for a long time, and writing actually comes pretty easily for me. And I think it's partly just that I was taught to do a lot of writing in school, and then I wrote for the student newspaper. I edited the student newspaper when I was at MIT. So for years and years, I've been writing and writing on deadline, large quantities. Also, if I were to sit down and write something from scratch that I'd never done before, it would take a long time. But in most cases, the things that I'm writing, for instance, on my blog, are coming from questions that I got in class that I then sort of try to scope out or try to research there. So I've already got a beginning, like a question. I've already got the end, which is the answer. And then sometimes I just sort of fill in the middle. And the fill in the middle, everyone has their own style. My style is to sort of go through it slowly and methodically, which is, I think, good for my readers, but it's also good for me, because it means that I'm sort of bootstrapping myself into the next set of things. And even my classes, I've started using my webinars in order to test new material. So I figure, you know, they're not paying anything. So if it's terrible, such is life. But if it's good, then I can probably make it even better for my paid classes. And I can spruce things up and have better examples and see what works well and what doesn't work well. So it's always a matter of sort of taking the content and improving it. Until then, like on the blog, I'd say it's probably in its most refined form, just because it's gone through so many iterations already of me thinking about it and talking about it.
So far, we have talked about how you got interested in programming and what you're doing right now. Really valuable pieces of information, but we still didn't get a picture of how you got started as a professional software engineer. Did you ever work as an employee?
Yes, I did. So when we were talking earlier about, you know, bachelor's and PhDs and master's, I mentioned that MIT has this 5-year master's program. So after 4 years, you typically get a bachelor's. And after 5 years, I think almost everyone does it now, you get a master's in computer science. And back when I was there, you had to sort of, test into, but you had to be accepted into this 5th year of the master's program, which I was not. But that acceptance or non-acceptance in the master's program comes 2 years after your first acceptance into the program. And your first acceptance is into just an internship over the summer working for a big company. So a whole bunch of companies come to MIT and they say, we want to have the people who are going to be in this program, regardless of if they're going to do a master's in the end or not. And so I was fortunate enough to work for HP. So basically during the summers, during college, I worked for HP's medical products group, which was then spun off to Agilent, which was then sold off to Philips. And every so often I go to the Philips website and see the thing that I was working on just many generations later. And for about 2.5 years, I worked for HP working on computer systems for hospitals. And it was okay. I learned a lot. And then a friend of mine from MIT called me up. And this is like, this is where the connections come in, right? This is where some of what we were talking about earlier in terms of diversity and how do people hire other people. It's all through personal connections. And so, or a lot of it is. And so basically a friend of mine was working at Time Warner. They said they were looking for a web guy. He said, oh, I know a web guy. My friend Reuven living up in Boston. And so I moved down to New York. And for about 8 months, I lived with my parents in New York. And I worked at Time Warner. And then I moved to Israel. And so that was basically my, I don't know, three and a half year period, plus the summers before that, working as a full-time employee. And it was very valuable to see how companies work from the inside and how they're structured and the management, and to sort of get my legs wet in the whole corporate structure. That said, once I moved to Israel, once I started doing consulting, and Time Warner actually agreed to be my first consulting client, which was very nice of them, I then sort of was learning a new way of doing work. And one which, at this point, I don't see myself going away from anytime soon. But I was sort of eased then both into the world of corporate work and the world of independent consulting work.
And then the rest is history, as they say.
That's right. The rest is a roller coaster.
So,
by the way, I just want to make it clear also, like, nowadays I'm very, very fortunate that I have these, you know, courses lined up months in advance. It's kind of crazy how far in advance they are. And yes, I'm turning down work, although I'm really bad at doing that. And so I even have, like, today I have to get back to two or three people and basically say to them, yes, I'd be happy to work with you. And it's a little dishonest probably because I don't know if I really have enough time to work with all of them. I probably should just say, no, I cannot work with you. But I don't like to disappoint people. And I like working with new people and meeting smart, interesting employees and projects. But believe me, 5-10 years ago, it was a very different story for me. I was, you know, on the job boards, emailing people saying, please, please hire me. And I've got this experience. And I was like, I don't understand. Why are they not hiring me? Yeah, why am I struggling so much? And of course, there are 1,001 reasons for that. I would say, by the way, that I wish I could remember his, I'll remember in a moment, but Robert, some of the other, has this thing called Let's Workshop. Mm-hmm. And Let's Workshop is a service where every day you get emailed leads that he has sifted through. So he basically says, here are 10 leads, and not all of them are going to apply to you. So don't have to go through the job board. So first of all, I think it's a great service. Second of all, the same guy, whose name I'm going to try to look up here, Robert, I don't know his last name.
Robert Williams.
Yeah. Anyway, Robert, he also wrote this ebook about how to write email to potential clients. Like someone is looking for a freelancer. How do you write to them? And it is a brilliant short book. And basically I read through this book. I said, oh, that's why no one ever hired me. Because what did I do? I sent this ridiculously long message with incredible detail because that's what I figured they wanted. And his point is, no, they want to save time and solve their problem. Send them something short. So everyone searches for work at some point, and everyone has to learn how to do it better. And perhaps if I had done it better, I would still be doing more development and less training, even though I'm really happy doing the training.
I read that book. I bought that book, and I read it. And I have been following some of the things that he's doing. But I found that to be a mixed bag, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard all good things, great things, and I'm really happy that he's doing well. But I found that the leads were perhaps skewed on one side. So if you are a WordPress developer, if you're a designer, then you probably have good luck with that. But otherwise, I'm not sure if that's... I mean, and again, that's a that's a particular service. We don't really want to talk about a particular service because... Yes, there are certain types of leads that he sends, and maybe the quality will go up or down. But we're trying to get some generic timeless advice.
Fair enough. Sorry.
So let's get into, like, this is good for somebody to know because most people when they are in high school, when they're in college, or maybe they're not studying but they're thinking about going into programming, they're thinking. First thing that I hear people say is, I need a computer science degree because that's how the society works. Sort of, you want to go into a professional field, you need to get a professional degree. That's a myth. You don't really need it in computer science. To be a software engineer, you don't need a degree. However, if you had a degree, you will benefit, and it will benefit you in different other ways. It probably won't matter to get your first job. I think that it doesn't matter as much to get a first couple of jobs. It matters in certain times, but it will help you in the long term, and that's evident from your description of how you went into college and how it helps you to do some higher order things like training and producing courses, and it sort of sets you apart, which is good. But from a point of view of a new developer, they should know. I think the message that I want to put out, and I think you want to put out, is that getting a job is not the only way of moving your career forward. There are other avenues. You can create a presence for yourself. You could do consulting, certainly contract type work, or you could do training if you get good at one aspect, and you can produce content that others can consume. There are ways of making some passive income, and you can try many different ways and of making money and keep your passion going. I think that's the message. In terms of how to get your first contract or how to get a few contracts, I think it's very important that we can talk. So this particular course, Let's Workshop, can be really valuable, and there are other avenues as well. But do you agree with this idea that a new developer, somebody who doesn't have the reputation, maybe doesn't have really strong expertise in any one thing, they have other options besides getting a job? Hi, everyone. I know that since you're listening to this show, you care about mentorship, you care about teaching, you care about learning, especially you care about learning software development, programming, and you need to do that if you want to teach somebody, and you need to do that in order to grow your career. So what is the most valuable or the most in, quote unquote, software development skill or programming language right now? It's JavaScript. But there are multiple levels of knowing JavaScript. Derek Bailey, a friend of the show, he was in episode 3, and he was amazing. You should check it out, mentoringdevelopers.com/episode3. He has a subscription service, which is a screencast service, so he does some stuff on the computer and records it, and you can watch it if you're subscribed. It's called watchmecode.net. He also sells these bundles. So he has a bunch of screencasts put together as a bundle, and you can buy it, and you don't have to subscribe to a monthly subscription fee, which is great, but it costs a little bit of money. So I talked to him, and he agreed to let one of my listeners have the entire Level Up Your JavaScript bundle for free. That sells for $98. It's on sale at $64, but you can have it for free. It's amazing, and I think that you will definitely enjoy it. It's something that it's knowledge that you need. It's about variable scopes. It's about this, which is the context in JavaScript and how it's used. It can be tricky. Object, prototype, truthiness, faultiness, and a lot of good stuff. I think his screencasts are good. I'm a subscriber. So if you want to be in the draw for a free bundle, a free Level Up Your JavaScript bundle, all you have to do is write me a comment. Write a comment, question, ask me a question, anything about the show that helps me understand if it's helpful for you, if you have any questions, if you have any suggestions for improvements, anything at all that's interesting that I can perhaps use on the show, and maybe I will take your name in the show. So anything at all, send it to me, and the best one will get a free bundle, Level Up Your JavaScript. So how do you do it? First of all, you can go to iTunes, mentoringdevelopers.com/iTunes, and you can leave a comment there, give it a rating, and then we'll read that. You can also go to the blog post that goes with this episode or any of the episodes that will be published in all the way until the end of January in 2016 and leave a comment. If you leave a comment, I'll read it, and if it's good, it'll be part of the drawing. And also, you can email me, us@mentoringdevelopers.com, us@mentoringdevelopers.com. If you're not able to, you know, send a comment in any other way, go ahead and send an email. And you can send multiples. You can send for every episode. You can send as many as you want. And the more comments you send, the more interesting stuff that you give us to read and maybe read out in an episode, then it'll increase your chances. So once again, level up your JavaScript. It's worth $64. It's worth a lot more than that, but he's selling it for $64. And you can have it. All you have to do is send us your questions, your comments, your advice, and your critique. So, I'm looking forward to reading all your comments.
For sure, for sure. Look, the world is desperate. Even as lots of people learn programming, the world is desperate still for developers. There's just not enough talent to solve all the problems that people have. And as time goes on, you would think that, you know, we'd be graduating more and more computer science degrees and more developers, and so the demand, like the supply demand balance, would have more supply. And yet demand keeps outstripping supply. So if you're interested in working in the computer world and you don't have a computer science degree, you can get a job. It might take you longer because people might look askance at you, or they might sort of put you into the secondary pile, but you will be able to get a job. And that job will lead to another job. And it just keeps going on and on from there. And you'll meet people, and they'll recommend you. And you'll have ideas of your own, maybe start a company or do consulting. Like, the world is your oyster. But one of the most instructive things that happened to me when I was at MIT was, as I said, I was the editor-in-chief of the student newspaper there. And there was this program called the Knight Fellowships, where they brought science journalists to MIT to spend a year taking courses. And the idea was they would be better science journalists as a result of taking classes with the undergrads. So, you know, there are a bunch of 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds taking class, and this 45-year-old reporter trying to just sort of keep up. Actually, some of them were very, very bright and very capable, so that their science journalism will be better. And we somehow stumbled into getting a meeting with them. And we had a great, great dinner and meeting, and it was terrific. And at some point, we went around the room and said, so, what's your background? How did you get into science journalism? And none of them had studied science, and none of them had studied journalism. And that's when I realized, oh, what you study in college does not determine your career. And I think it's especially true in the computer industry. You can, you know, your career can move around and change, and it's what you make of it. You might need to work harder without the degree. You might need to compromise a bit more at the beginning without a degree, but it's still possible.
Yeah, and certainly you don't need to get a job if you're if you live in the middle of Idaho or Utah or Alabama, and there are no tech companies, or the tech job that you have, they pay minimum wage. You don't have to accept that. That's possible because of the internet, because of the possibility of working remotely, possibility of starting a website. You know, if you want to make a simple website.
Oh, sorry. I just lost you. You were talking about Alabama. And now you're...
that's when your Skype are like, what? Alabama? Oh, they just censored it. yeah, it's an interesting experience I had going to college in California and people. Let's just say that they have less than favorable opinion of Alabama over there. Okay, so moving on. I was going to talk about, you know, to the massive majority of developers or aspiring developers, people who want to be developers, and they have a barrier. They find a barrier. This is not a real barrier. My contention is you can do it no matter where you are in the world, as long as you have a good internet connection, as long as you have a quiet space of study, as long as you're motivated, you can be a software engineer. And if you can't find somebody to hire you, you don't need that to deter you. You can still do something. You can still make websites, put your content out there. You will need to be persistent, because one of the things that will stop you is that you will give up. If you don't give up, if you keep doing it, you'll keep learning. Eventually, you will get recognized, simply because there are not enough people doing this exact thing that I'm talking about. Persevering with maybe writing a blog post, maybe commenting on Stack Overflow, maybe following podcasts and commenting. I don't know. There could be a bunch of things that people can do. But I was wondering if one of the things they could do would be to start a consulting company on their own, maybe as their first job right out of college. Is that a thing? What do you think, Reuven, that that's feasible?
People can do that. And I think in the world of the web, like, if you've got some experience from college or from high school, that's a thing to do. But I think that it's hard to setting up a company, even if it's a consulting company, it's still a company, and it's going to be somewhat hard. And you don't want to be learning all the technology and all the business at the same time. So I think, it's not a bad idea to have your own consulting company, your own startup right out of college. But you should, I think, only do that if you've sort of gotten the technical chops already. What I did, sort of waiting 2-3 years and then starting my own company, in some ways I think that was a very good way to go, because I had some work experience, some business experience, even though the workplaces where I was were such huge companies, and like my company is so tiny, in some ways there was no relationship there.
Absolutely. So the advice is, if you want to start in software engineering and you don't have a lot of technical experience right now, you have limited experience, try to get that. If you want to work for if you want to make an e-commerce website, let's say you want to sell shoes and you want to have a shoes website, then maybe you should get a job in a company that sells shoes, right? And then you'll get to learn how they are set up, what problems they encounter, how they resolve it, and then say, okay, now that I have the skills, the business skills, as well as the technical skills, now I can do something on my own. But if you start from a blank slate, you could fail. But again, that could be, we have heard a lot of stories about, teenagers starting companies and being successful, but those are rare.
Yeah, I think those are outliers. By the way, the only caveat I would have with what you just said about, like, shoes, for instance, not to pick on the shoe industry, is you want to make sure that if you have a full-time job, that you don't have a non-compete clause. Right, because if you and these are ridiculous and stupid, and yet they exist. And some states in the U.S. Outlaw them now. But let's say you work for a shoe company or a shoe e-commerce company, and you decide you're going to go off and start your own shoe e-commerce company. They might come after you, whether it's justified or not, and sue you. And is this likely? Probably not. Or Paul Graham from Y Combinator basically says, he says this about patents, but he basically says, if you're small, no one will sue you. And if you're big, everyone will sue you. he's like, it doesn't matter whether it's actually justified or not. And there's something to that.
Well, that's a very good point, because I completely forgot about this non-compete thing. But obviously, non-compete has a time limit, right? It's maybe for a year, for the next 2 years at most, they can sue you. But after that, if you've been separated long enough, you would be okay. But then, you have to go through your contract to see what it says.
Yeah.
So, we want to wrap up this interview at some point. It's been going on for a while. I think I'm going to have to chop it up into two episodes, because I think a lot of information. And I think that during the pre-interview, we were talking and we had a lot of, pretty good discussion there. So, I think we can include some of those clips in there as well. So I don't want to keep you here for too long, but there are a few questions that I'd still like to ask you, because I think your opinions will be really valuable for our audience.
Sure.
So you worked for a few years as a new developer at a few companies, Time Warner, you said, and after that you became independent. Was it easy for you when you were starting out, people accepting you and giving you responsibility, Was it hard to start out?
What, in my consulting practice?
As a junior employee.
Or as an employee. I think if I were a little less naive, a little more aware of what was going on, I would have realized that they were sort of rolling their eyes at things I was doing. I was just sort of young and blasé and naive about it. So, for example, I figured, well, I was working at HP. It was a big company. So I would get in around 9 and leave around 5, and that was that. And I made some progress. And I guess my progress was good enough that, they didn't complain too much. I didn't get the stellar employee evaluation at the end of the year or each year. But I didn't get a terrible one either. It was just like, okay, keep doing what you're doing, which I think testifies in some ways to the way that big companies work. There's not an expectation that you're going to move mountains, but that's actually nice in some ways, right? You don't want to be in a pressure cooker all the time necessarily. But they were nice to me, and they had some sort of mentoring program when I was at HP that another slightly older developer was supposed to mentor me. I don't think he really did very much. I can't blame him because he was probably a year or two older. What did he know in terms of mentoring or helping or showing me the ropes? My manager was very nice to me. And I do remember once going to him and saying, I don't have anything to do. What should I work on? He said, okay, never say that when you're working at a company. we will find things for you to do. But I also feel like, I was just goofing off a lot. I was editing the Emacs FAQ and I was doing that at work, which is probably not a good idea. I just felt like I had all this time to do stuff. But when there was crunch time, and that happened a few times, then, I had to roll up my sleeves and put in extra hours. There are a few times I came in on Sundays to work. So they were very nice to me. But I think I definitely felt more at home at Time Warner, my next job, in part because it might have been a huge company, but they treated us like a startup. And that's when I realized, okay, I'm a small company kind of guy. And that's like, some people are big company people, some people are small company people, and that's okay. The world needs all kinds. And I just can't deal with a large bureaucracy and the facelessness. By the time I left Time Warner, our group was about 40 people, and it was already feeling big. And I still happen to be on excellent terms, I think, with all the people with whom I work there. So we really got along well. It was a half hacker party and half getting a lot of great stuff done.
I think that it's important for us to recognize that you were starting out and you kept good relations, and that helped you to get your first contract. And it's very important. If you're going to leave a job, don't leave on bad terms.
Oh, my God. I totally, totally, totally agree. That's very important. I remember I was petrified of telling my first boss at HP that I was going to leave, that I was quitting. I really didn't know how to tell him, and so I sat him down, we sat down together, I told him. He said, oh, okay, I understand. Because right, for him, he's a manager, he understands people come and go, and that's a normal part of the corporate world, and that's in part why corporations work the way they do, because people are, to some degree at least, interlocking parts or interchangeable parts. But I left on very good terms, and leaving Time Warner, I left on excellent terms with people. Look, and the U.S. is a big country. Israel is a tiny country. I think total we've got like 8 million people living here. And the computer industry is very small. Everyone knows each other. I mean, to some degree or another. And if you are not nice to people, it will haunt you. It really will. So besides just the ethics of being nice to people, practically speaking, be nice to people. Be nice to people all the time, but even when you leave. Because you never know who is going to be hiring, who is going to be talking to whom, and you don't want to get the reputation as that guy who's impossible to work with.
It does create a problem, though. In my mind, it's really a good principle to live by, that you should be nice to people. And it's very easy when you're getting along. It's hard when you're not getting along, but even so, you have to watch your language, and you have to make sure you don't send any nasty emails as you're leaving, so that people still have a good opinion of you. You may encounter them. Even if you live in a large country like the United States, there's still this other problem, which is, what if that person is against you because of your cultural background, maybe because of your ethnicity, maybe because sexual orientation? There's this real problem of, we talked about in the pre-interview about cultural fit, and so what we have to do as senior people, as managers, as people who are running a team, to understand that people have biases. This is natural. And if one person is biased against the other, no matter what the other person does, sometimes it's hard for, you know, there to be harmony. And take things with a pinch of salt, and we have to, as senior people, as people with a little bit of authority and power over junior developers, we have to open up, open our hearts up a little bit, I feel, have some empathy. And if somebody's is doing something that's doesn't fit with our own idea of a cultural fit and a little bit different, we have to give them the space, because I think in a professional environment, our personal biases, we should leave them behind. And I want to give the message to people who may have felt that they have had, you know, biased treatment because of perceived or real, you know, racial bias or whatever, that they don't have to please somebody that is being oppressive. If you're a woman and you're being sexually harassed and you are leaving a company and that person is bothering you, you don't have to be nice to them. So given that caveat, I think in general, we can say that it's always good to be on good terms with, in a professional environment. But I think as people who run teams, I would say it's very important. It's on us. The onus is on us to make sure that people are comfortable, that we don't create an environment where one person has, you know, too much authority over the other when their bias can come into play. What do you think about that?
Right. Look. I'll tell you. First of all, I'm just, and again, this like testifies to my naivete, I think. I'm just always perplexed that like these sorts of biases would exist. And I mean, I'm not saying I'm not biased, because everyone has their own built-in biases, but you know, the out and out racism, sexism, whatever that I hear about. I mean, come on. Like, that's just ridiculous. If you want your company to succeed, if you want your team to succeed, you're going to want to hire the best people. And best, of course, is comprised of several different dimensions. But one of those dimensions should not be what is this person's ethnic, religious, cultural, sexual background, right? Those are all secondary, tertiary, if they enter into it at all. If someone is treating you inappropriately at work, though, I don't know if being mean to them is necessarily the right response, even if it's maybe the natural response. The problem is, like, let's say you're in a big company, or even a medium company, there's probably a human resources department, and they are there to help you. When I was at HP, the HR people were super, super nice to me, not with any biased things. Like, it was just when I was leaving. And they are there not necessarily for the company's interest, although, I mean, obviously they're company employees, but really to help the employees as much as possible. And they did help me with when I left. They said, if you leave 3 days later, then you get your stock options for like this quarter. And I was like, okay, I'm leaving after those 3 days, that sort of thing. And they even tried to help me in terms of finding work and healthcare and all sorts of other stuff. So if you are experiencing any sort of bias, it's totally inexcusable, and you should go talk to your human resources department. The problem, of course, is what if you're in a tiny company, or you feel like you don't have any other options in terms of work? And it's easy to say that, in the computer industry, lots of people, you'll have lots of work options, but it's not necessarily true. And that's a terrible situation to be in, right? You never want to be in the situation where you feel trapped and you can't leave a job, even though they're treating you terribly. And then maybe, right, maybe you have to not, I mean, I'm not saying you should accept abuse or harassment of any sort, but maybe it's time to even be mean and point this out, as opposed to talk to someone else about it. It's difficult. It's difficult. And I think we hear, on the one hand, we complain that the computer industry is not diverse enough, which is, I think, a reasonable complaint. On the other hand, I think we're discovering why, that some of the folks in it don't want it to be more diverse, even though there is so much room for everyone. As I said, there's like an insatiable demand right now. Anyway, I think it's a difficult, I'll tell you, I mean, working in Israel, and here I don't want to open up like too much of a kettle of worms. But like, in Israel, we also have minorities of different sorts. We have Arab minorities, we have women, we have different religious groups. And yet, who are the employees at most of the high-tech companies? It is typically, the Ashkenazi, the European-descended Jewish males. That's changing over time, just as it's changing everywhere. But you see it. I was just at a company teaching last week where they happen to be in an area of Israel where there's a very large Arab population. And so I was very happy to see there were a lot of Arab employees, right? It's not even a question there. Clearly, they're going to hire the best people for the job, regardless of their ethnicity. But I think that there's partly a bias against hiring them elsewhere, and partly it's sort of self-reinforcing, where people are only going to go where they know other people, and so they're not going to go where they don't know anyone.
Yeah, and that's always going to be present. But I think that we can't really turn an entire population into, let's say, extroverts over time or people who are full of self-confidence. And we can't change, you know, the majority, the masses. We can't say all women should be empowered, so from today they're all going to be super confident and they're going to demand their rights. But what you can do is, when you're in the administration, I just noticed that you said, I got distracted a little bit because you sent a message that we need to wrap up, which we do. And this has been a fantastic conversation, and I feel like I've taken a lot of your time. So let's see if we can wrap it up. If you could start over, will you do something differently?
Maybe. When I was working at HP, they told us we were moving far away, and I did not have a car at that point. And they said, what are you going to do? I said, I guess I'm going to get a car. And they said, right. So on the one hand, if I were to start over, I would have said, no, I'm living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There are lots of startups here. I'll just work for one of these startups, right? I would have been happy there. They would have been happy with me. At the same time, I'm glad that I had the experience. And that's really the only thing, the experience of continuing to work with a big company and having to deal with being a corporate pawn. That's probably the only major point in my career that I sort of could see it going one way or the other. But otherwise, I'm actually pretty happy with how things have gone.
Do you listen to podcasts? Do you watch screencasts? Are there any blogs you'd like to recommend?
I listen to a ton of podcasts. I'm constantly taking the train and walking, and so I constantly have earphones in my ears. Whether it's programming type podcasts like, Startups for the Rest of Us, I'm sure I'm going to miss out a whole bunch of them. There are a whole lot of really good programming podcasts, software engineering podcasts, consulting podcasts. Those are sort of one category that I listen to. I'm also sort of obsessively interested in politics. So I listen to things like the Slate Political Gabfest the Podcast for America about the U.S. Presidential election. And I listen to things like the New Yorker podcasts, The Economist, really all the time. And then they're fun ones, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and Ask Me Another. So it's not unusual if you see me walking down the street that I'll have earphones in my ear and that I will be laughing very loudly.
What's your best advice for software shops?
Communication. The thing that the whole agile movement, revolution, however wish to describe it, is basically saying we need to communicate more. We need to communicate more and more clearly among ourselves and with our customers. And if you can do that, you'll win. Your customers are not interested in super brilliant nerds, much as we would love for that to be the case. Your customers are interested in people on whom they can rely, who will make their businesses better. And in many cases, in most cases, that means clear upfront communication and reliability more than technical genius.
And what's your best advice for new and aspiring developers?
To realize that you will never know everything, but you got to keep trying. And so it's this balancing act of try to learn all the time, as we were discussing earlier, enjoying the learning how to learn well, finding your niche so that you can concentrate on learning things that are perhaps more appropriate, more interesting. At the same time, realizing that there's no way that any human can possibly learn all of the stuff that's necessary. And so you'll just be winging it part of the time. And that's all of us, even those of us who sound like we're brilliant and we know what we're doing, we're winging it a lot of the time.
Absolutely. So we're coming to the close, and I'd like to give you the chance to talk about some of the projects you're working on. Where can people go to find out more about you? I know you have a bunch of projects, and I'd like to give you the time to talk about your current and future endeavors.
Sure. So let's see. in terms of regular writing, as I mentioned, I have my newsletter, which you can subscribe to from my website, learner.co.il, or from my blog, blog.learner.co.il. Why have I not unified those? Because, you know, the Sandler's children, you know, the Shoemaker's children go barefoot. And so I write on my blog probably once every 2 weeks or so, once every 3 weeks. I write to my mailing list about once every 1 or 2 weeks. There is some overlap there among the content. I try to do a webinar about once every month or two, and those are announced on my blog and on my newsletter. You can follow me on Twitter at Reuven M. Lerner. And so those are sort of the general ways that I communicate with the world about what I'm up to, and I'm obviously very, very happy to hear from people. You can also email me, reuven@learner.co.il. I'm very happy to respond to people. Just realize I'm often terrible at responding on time to email. So if I don't respond to you right away, don't take it personally. It's not you. In terms of my project, my first ebook, Practice Makes Python, is at, surprisingly enough, practicemakespython.com, and that's a book of 50 Python exercises. It assumes you've already learned some Python, and you want to strengthen it, and you want to gain some fluency. And this is these are 50 exercises that I've used in my classes with large companies, and small companies for that matter, to try to help people improve fluency. And the idea is that the book will make you sweat, and it'll make you curse. Well, maybe not. But it'll make you like work hard, and through the working hard and then reading the solutions, hopefully you can... you can gain some insights there. I'm working on a similar book now called Practice Makes Regex, which I'm probably going to open for pre-sale to my mailing list in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So like early in mid-November, probably mid-November at some point. And then I'll make it available for general sale, obviously, as well. I've got my Daily Tech Video site, dailytechvideo.com. I've got my mandarinweekly.com site for those of you learning Chinese. And by the way, learning Chinese is super cool and fun and not nearly as hard as you might imagine. And if you learn it, people think you're brilliant. So show off to your friends, learn a little Chinese, and it's really fun and not that complex. What else? I'm starting to do more and more coaching and working with technical trainers. So I've got a coaching program mentioned on my blog. Those of you interested in doing technical training, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. I'm also going to work on an ebook about how to do technical training. That's going to be announced again on my mailing list. And I think that's it for now. I think that's a whole podcast right there just describing what I'm up to.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of information that you gave us today, especially the list of things that you're working on, you worked on in the past. We'll try to put all of that in the show notes. Hopefully you'll give me all that information so I can include it on the post that goes along with this particular episode. It was such a pleasure talking to you, and we took so much of your time. I appreciate it.
Awesome. It's been my pleasure indeed. I really enjoyed our conversation also, and I hope the listeners enjoyed this. And really, like, if you're a new developer, don't worry. We're as I said, we're all winging it, and it gets easier and more exciting over time. And you're in a great, great, fun industry. It's not often that people pay you to do cool things. So, hey, what a great deal, right?
Excellent. Thank you, Reuven. We'll see you later.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.